morning, Judge Sykes, Judge Mannion, and Judge Tinder. On behalf of Mr. Arroyo-Joya, we are bringing five issues before the court. The first concerns whether his plea to aggravated identity theft under 18 United States Code 1028A was valid. And then there are a series of sentencing issues. The one that I will address my attention to today is the application of Pugh versus the United States to his sentencing. First, with respect to the plea to aggravated identity theft, Mr. Arroyo-Joya's plea was invalid because under Flores-Figueroa versus the United States, a person must specifically acknowledge that the information that was used belonged to another actual person. And this did not happen in Mr. Arroyo-Joya's case. Mr. Arroyo-Joya proceeded to plead pursuant to a plea declaration which he and his attorney authored. There was no agreement with the government.
And I understand without an agreement, the government wasn't bound to dismiss the other charges, but if you prevail on getting plea to count 37 or 36 set aside, then can't count 37 charging the same thing for another victim be refiled as well as the other counts that were dismissed?
That is possible, Your Honor.
And acceptance of responsibility would be lost, I suppose, if those go to trial and so on?
If it were to go to trial, that's true. It's not at all clear that either one of those paths would be pursued.
And your client's willing to take that risk?
He is, Your Honor.
Okay.
And with respect to the court in Flores-Figueroa addressed the need for specific recognition that the information belonged to another individual because that's the only way of distinguishing 1028A from 1028. And in this particular case, while Mr. Arroyo-Joya, through his plea declaration, acknowledged that he committed fraud and that he falsely used information, he did not acknowledge that he knew that the information that he used of a Lizelle and Borgo as charged in count 36 was an actual person.
So had he been explicitly informed of that, you're saying he would not have pled guilty?
That's correct.
And did he seek to set aside the plea in the district court?
He did not, Your Honor. And this is it's our contention that this is his first opportunity to raise this issue. Because neither his lawyer, the government lawyer, nor the judge raised the issue of specific acknowledgement. And so he really wasn't in a position, based on his representation in the district court, to know that he had pled guilty to something whose conduct did not fall within the bounds of the statute. And Rule 11, of course, in the advisory notes, provides that one of the purposes of the plea colloquy is to ensure and to protect a defendant from pleading guilty voluntarily to something that is not, in fact, within the bounds of the charged conduct. So Mr. Arroyo-Joya was in no position to know that what he had done was acknowledge guilt to conduct that wasn't included within the charge that he was being accused of.
Can't we infer from what his counsel said by way of a description of the facts that he was pleading guilty to that can't we infer his knowledge consistent with Flores-Figueroa based on, you know, that he was admitting that he stole the vital information, date of birth, social security number, etc., for a lady named Lizelle Embargo?
That might ordinarily be true, Your Honor. The problem with that in Mr. Arroyo-Joya's particular case is that when he described in his plea declaration what he actually did, he talked about getting information from the Internet, getting photos from the Internet, making up false vital statistics, and basically creating identities out of whole cloth. So it's not really possible to infer that he knew. For instance, he also acknowledged that he purchased information from credit card hackers and used that information. So it's not clear at all that he would have any specific knowledge that the information that he had belonged to an actual human being.
Except it is with respect to this victim.
Well, I think that it's not. And he doesn't acknowledge that. He acknowledges that he used false information and that he was fraudulent in his use of this information. But he does not and the government concedes that he does not.
Wasn't there an exhibit used at sentencing that listed Imbrogo as a victim and had her address and described her in ways that showed her to be a true person?
There was an exhibit that demonstrated that at sentencing, Your Honor.
Exhibit 8, wasn't it?
But the problem with that is that that is an after-the-fact determination. And the relevant question is
but
what...
But at sentencing, your client didn't say, wait a minute, or his counsel didn't say, this exhibit's not right, this is listing this person as a real person.
No, he didn't. But as I have said, the fact that neither his counsel nor the government counsel nor the court pointed out to him at the time that he entered his plea that he had to acknowledge specifically that he knew that this person wasn't a real person means that not only did he not know that, but his counsel was unaware of that.
Well, I guess you're saying that, in fact, in the reply brief in our court, it's the first time your client indicates that he would not have pled guilty. At sentencing, he didn't have an opportunity when he realized that by Exhibit 8, this is a real person. He didn't have a chance to attempt to withdraw his plea at that point.
I think what he could have, if he had known that what he had done was to plead guilty to a count in which he had to specifically acknowledge that he knew that. I mean, he did not know
He knew what the penalty was. He knew what the consequence was.
Right, but he did not know the connection or that he had to specifically acknowledge. And for all that we know, he did not specifically know that this person was a real person.
Well, actually, that can be inferred from what was said by his counsel. In fact, the secondary question about whether he or his counsel or the court or the prosecutor understood the legal import of the Flores-Figueroa holding is a separate issue, but we can infer his knowledge that there was this actual victim, Lizelle Imbrogo, by virtue of what his counsel said and he in laying out the factual basis, and then he agreed to the factual basis.
Well, actually, I respectfully disagree with that, Your Honor. Well, he knew, I'm sorry, that the information that he had was false, which is what his attorney acknowledges. He never acknowledges that this person actually existed, as opposed to being one of the many whose identity that he created based on information that he had purchased.
Well, counsel refers to her as a lady named Lizelle Imbrogo, as opposed to some phantom set of numbers on the internet. So that's where the inference, the reasonable inference, arises, that everybody knew they were talking about a real person's identifying information as opposed to phantom or made-up numbers.
I respectfully disagree with that because what his counsel says is that he knew he was not the owner and that he was fraudulently using those names. But he doesn't say that this person was an actual person or that the defendant knew it. And I think that when you're talking about a change of plea, you don't want to go too far into inferring knowledge which is not explicitly given. Because one of the requirements of entering a knowing and voluntary plea is that a person acknowledges each of the elements, is guilt of each of the elements of the offense for which he is pleading guilty.
I think you need a drink of water. You're having a little trouble. You want to go take a sip,
and,
okay?
And could she have some extra time for that? It's hard to tell whether it's the mic or the speaker.
When the record is not clear, I think it is dangerous to make inferences about a defendant's knowledge when the very purpose of the plea colloquy is to ensure that the defendant is knowingly and voluntarily entering into this plea. And if neither his counsel nor the court ensured that this specific element under Flores-Figueroa was pled to, then I think we can't go very far in inferring what may or may not be true from what his defense counsel said. And I think we're more in the realm of the fraud aspect of 1028 as opposed to the aggravated identity theft. This is the key issue that separates whether a person is guilty of one or the other, and so inferring knowledge when it's not explicit or not clear is really not fair and undermines the purpose of having a knowing and voluntary plea. If I could touch briefly on the issue of Pew versus the United States. Mr. Arroyo-Joya's sentencing was completed prior to the Supreme Court's decision in Pew, saying that the ex post facto clause does apply to the sentencing guidelines. And were it to have applied in this particular case, it would have changed Mr. Arroyo-Joya's guideline calculation significantly.
Of course, the judge said he was going to give the same sentence.
Well, actually, he didn't say exactly that. And this case.
What exactly did he say?
What he said was that, first of all, the sentence I'm going to enter is slightly below the guideline range because I think that some credit has to be given for the last 4 years, and then he talks about that. And says, and for that reason, the sentence I impose is going to be below the guideline range, and that it's not necessarily tied to the guideline range, but reflected the court's assessment. So it's not necessarily tied to is somewhat ambiguous, certainly when you compare it or set it in the context of what he actually did. He spent several sentencing hearings making a very careful calculation of what the guidelines were, and then he clearly states that he's entering, it's his intent to enter a sentence that's slightly below in recognition for all of the progress that Mr. Arroyo-Joya had made during the time period in which the case was entered. And this is very different from what this court did in his co-defendant's case, Mr. Rabiu, where in the court said, frankly, regardless of what any other court in the future may rule, the appropriate offense level and guideline calculation was, I feel the sentence I'm about to impose is appropriate in this case for the reasons that I've stated here today. So he was very clear, and he knew how to be very clear about saying, no matter what, I'm going to impose the same sentence. He was more qualified in dealing with Mr. Arroyo-Joya. And the other important distinction between Mr. Arroyo-Joya and Mr. Rabiu is that this issue was not raised and could not have been raised because the decision had not yet been made. In Mr. Rabiu's case, it had been made, and it was raised. And the court was saying, regardless of whether this ex post facto decision applies or doesn't, I'm still going to impose the same sentence. And the other distinction between Mr. Arroyo-Joya and Mr. Rabiu was that Mr. Rabiu, the court said, had a very dismissive attitude. And while this was a serious offense, the defendant was not appreciative of his wrong, and he needed to be deterred, which was certainly not the case with Mr. Arroyo-Joya, where the court went on at some length about the positive steps that he had taken to make his life better. And the fact that he said that he was going to reduce the sentence slightly below the guideline range was an indicator that he was, in fact, tying his sentence to what the guideline range was. And if the proper guideline had been...
You jumped over the last thing that he said in that sequence, and it's that the sentence is based on more on the 3553 factors that I have just articulated than on any particular guideline range. And he,
right.
And he had extensive discussions touching on those factors of 3553A.
That's
particularly
true.
Recognizing that the post conviction or the post arrest rehabilitation, the individual characteristics of this defendant.
Yes, I think that.
So why doesn't that fit much into the line of what we found in the Rabiu case?
Because I think it's not clear that if the guidelines, in fact, had been lower and he had had the opportunity to make the decision about whether the four-point enhancement applied under the ex post facto clause or it didn't, that it's certainly conceivable that his sentence, too, would have been lower. Because he clearly said his intent was to impose a sentence that was slightly below the guideline, suggesting that if the guideline were other, then it would certainly be lower. The other thing is, I think, in pointing to the 3553A factors here, he was justifying why he was going below the guideline range. That was not an issue in Mr. Rabiu's case, because he didn't go below the guideline range, and he had other factors to be concerned with. So without him ever having the opportunity to address this significant increase, I don't think that it would be fair to conclude that he necessarily would have imposed the same sentence as he would had the determination been other.
There were a number of defendants here. Are they in various stages of being sentenced, or are these although for the same conspiracy?
There are a number of them, one of whom is a fugitive, Mr. Raviu, whose case has already been heard by this court, Mr. Edward Adesokan, who did not appeal, and his case has been resolved, and I believe there's one more individual whose case may be pending before this court.
Thank you, Ms. Gambino.
I'm out of time. Thank you.
Ms. Greenwald.
May it please the court. Beginning with the last issue, while it's fresh in our minds, first of all, I believe defense counsel maybe misspoke, but if she's claiming that this issue, this Pew issue, was not raised below, then the government maintain the standard of review should be plain error. It's the government's position that a fair reading of the record is that in a footnote, defense counsel there did adopt Mr. Raviu's Pew argument. So she can't have it both ways, would be the government's position. It was either raised or it wasn't. And the government believes it was raised, and was the court, this district court, who also sentenced Mr. Raviu, was very familiar with this Pew argument. And in sentencing the defendant, yes, made a reference to giving him credit for the time he spent awaiting sentence and going below the guideline range, but then went on to talk about the aggravating factors involving the seriousness of the offense, and then went further on to say, quote, "The sentence I impose is not necessarily tied to the court's finding as to the guideline range. It is, I believe, the appropriate sentence in this case, regardless of whether the guideline range is that being argued by the government or that being argued by the defendant." And, Your Honors, even if the court wasn't thinking specifically of Pew when it said that, the fact of the matter was this defendant had argued against almost every single enhancement that was added by the district court, except for the sophisticated means. So under the guideline calculations of the defendant, it was even lower than taking away the 4 points for Pew. So this court, if we're going to take the court for what it clearly said, was realizing that the defense calculation was even lower than taking away 4 points, was even lower than this range that if they credited the Pew argument. So the court was well aware of the possible guideline computations that could have been here, and said, this 85 months that I'm giving on with this count, I think, given these aggravating factors, taking into account the 4 years of mitigation that from being on home confinement, this is a fair sentence. I think he said it clearly in context.
Are the judges sort of routinely using the safe harbor language now?
Well, I think it depends on the context of the case. And are you asking whether the district courts are?
I'm just, you're in the trenches all the time, so.
Yes, well, I think it depends on the case. I think it really does. And, you know, this court has made it clear it's not going to just rubber stamp that kind of language. So if the district courts, you know, on occasion do use that, I think if it's not clear that it's in the context of that case, after careful consideration of what the arguments were, what the alternative calculations could be, that they should be aware, and I think are aware, that it won't just be taken as a rubber stamp on the sentence to save it from coming back. But this was not such a case. This case, this judge spent 3 days on the sentencing hearing, very carefully considering each of the arguments. The court was well aware in this case of what the potential guideline ranges could be. And in imposing sentence, didn't just throw out it's a serious case, didn't just throw out it's mitigating factors. He spent, I mean, neither of the parties in argument this morning have really gone through it, but there's a whole paragraph on the seriousness of this crime and why that was weighing in to the factors too. So I think when the court goes through this kind of meticulous analysis, it's not just a rubber stamp here. And I think this also was a court that, like I say, especially within the review context, was really well aware of this Pew argument, because that had been the focus point of this co-defendant. And this defendant was sentenced after that.
Ms. Greenwald, I asked about the count 37 that was dismissed. Is there anything that would, if this defendant gets relief on count 36, the plea, is there anything that would bar you from refiling count 37?
I don't believe so. Any of the I think there might have even been additional counts, Your Honor, that were dismissed
other,
this to him.
There were fraud counts.
Right. I don't see why we could not revisit any of the counts we dismissed in response to
the guideline calculation. He got 3 levels for acceptance of responsibility. Is that right?
You know what? I know we got 2, and I might have gotten 3. I cannot remember as I stand here, Your Honor, but he may well have.
All right. Well, what can you point to that would show that the defendant at the time he pled knew that count 36 involved a real person?
Absolutely, Your Honor. So remember, I will go right to answering that. First of all, there's never been a contest, even on appeal, that Ellie was a real person. It's just, you know, the evidence of that throughout the record is abundant. Also, the case law is absolutely clear that in analyzing this issue, you don't look only to the confines of either his declaration or to what happened at the guilty plea. You look at the entire record, because it's when the court enters judgment that an error, if an error occurred.
So if it's something that came up at sentencing after the plea,
absolutely.
It still goes to show that he had knowledge that it was a real person?
Absolutely. Because the error, if one occurred here, does not occur until the court enters judgment. It's not simply just accepting the plea. And so the case law, and we cite them in our brief, say that you look at the entire record of the case, including things that happened at sentencing. But here there's enough both at the plea and later on. And the things at the plea are, the defendant admitted in his plea declaration to obtaining identification for Ellie and acknowledged that information to be vital information that included her name and social security number. And that's at the transcript at page 17. And I'm sorry, that wasn't in the plea declaration, that was at the guilty plea. The record shows that defendant actually, as part of his fraud, sought information for real people. In the plea declaration, he expressly admitted that his fraudulent activities included using stolen identities, that he searched the internet for names and vital information, that he bought vital information from internet hackers, and at the time of his arrest, he had on his person actual bank records of real bank customers who were filling out worksheets that had been stolen, clearly, from some bank location, people's applications for credit cards with their, or for bank accounts with their actual identifiers. Now, none of that was LE, but it showed that this is the kind of information he dealt in. And additionally, and the case law supports this, that you can look at the use to which the false identity was put to gather, to infer reasonably from circumstantially that the defendant knew that this was a real person. He used this person's ID, her social security number, her name, to open not just a business bank account, but also to obtain credit card merchant terminal, which is the actual, you know, when you go into a business and the business runs your credit card through a terminal. That's the kind of terminal we're talking about here. And in this case, they were dispersed, these terminals that they filed the false applications from, were from like middlemen commercial institutions. So the credit card company would hire these intermediaries who would then provide the terminals to businesses. And it is inconceivable and belies common sense to think that these businesses wouldn't check out that embargo, this home renovation, the owner of it wasn't a real person, and that social security number that was providing didn't belong to a real person before they gave them a credit card terminal and started paying them thousands of dollars based on these credit card receipts they were submitting. It's just not defies logic to think that he would think he could get away with that with a completely fictitious person. Did he create fictitious businesses? Absolutely. But they were all premised on having an actual owner who tied back to a real social security number. So all of that circumstantially supports it. And in addition, there were documents in the FBI agent's report that came in at sentencing and submitted, attached to a sworn affidavit by the agent that the information was true and correct, that also supported that Ellie was a real person and how it was used in the context of this scheme. So all of that evidence, Your Honor, particularly under the plain error standard upon which we're operating, I think the reality of what happened in this case is that everyone, the court, the defendant's counsel, and certainly the government, operated under the understanding that this was a real person. That was just the whole context of this crime, the scheme, everything was going on, was Ellie was a real person. And that's how the language proceeded at the plea, that's how everything proceeded. And again, I think defense counsel misspoke when she talked about the charged conduct. The charge in this case has never been suggested that was an element was left out of the charge in this case. The case was properly charged, defendant properly admitted he was aware of the charge in this case, and the factual foundation of this case and the entire context of the proceedings fully support, particularly under a plain error standard, that defendant had knowledge, sufficient knowledge to sustain this charge. In fact, had we gone to trial, this would have been the evidence we'd introduced to prove him guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. So it was sufficient. And I would also add that under the plain error standard, it's the defendant's burden to show somewhere from this record, rather than an out-of-court statement, he wouldn't have entered this plea. And logic just doesn't support that conclusion. As Your Honors pointed out, he got acceptance of responsibility. The evidence was more than sufficient to sustain it. There's just no basis to conclude. I've not heard an assertion of actual innocence here. Ellie is a real person. There's really no basis to conclude the defendant, who's an innocent person who had no idea this was a real person being used in a scheme and now stands convicted of a crime he did not commit. That's not what's going on in this case. And for that reason, too, this court should not exercise its discretion to overturn this conviction based on plain error. So, unless the court has any other questions, the government would submit both on our brief and our argument today that defendant's convictions and sentence should be affirmed.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Gambino, you had used up all your time, but I'll give you a minute in rebuttal if you've got something to add.
Your Honors, the relevant question here is not whether Ellie was a real person, but whether Mr. Arojo-Joya knew that she was. And everybody concedes that he did not expressly acknowledge this, and that Flores-Figueroa requires that he do. So it's simply not fair to say that based on information that was provided to him, when we don't have any idea whether his attorney counseled him, that part of the proof for this aggravated identity theft was that he explicitly acknowledged that he knew this was a real person at the time that he did it. And given the other evidence in the case in which he said that a lot of what he did was create fictitional people, which he did on a number of occasions for a number of different businesses, there's no principled way of distinguishing whether this was such a case or whether he had knowledge when he didn't explicitly say so. We'd ask that his plea to count 36 be vacated and that the case be remanded for resentencing on the other count.
All right. Thank you very much. Our thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.